To introduce our main speaker for this evening, Ken C. from LA.
You're the mic guy. Higher. 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 There we go. Yeah, that's fine. I've done this. There we go. I'm Ken Cross. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you to Lori for asking me to come down. I've known Lori and John and Earl for many, many, many years. John was just talking to me before where he was at a meeting with my sponsor's house with his baby like 16 years ago. And it's amazing how quickly time goes by. Now he's driving. Happy birthday to Carol and Robert. I get emotional when I talk. You know, I love seeing signers at meetings. I've spoken at deaf meetings. I've sponsored a deaf man. I know how hard of a disability is for deaf people to get sober. That's one thing. Two is, I'm always really tempted to tell a story from my fourth step and see how she translates some of the words, you know? And see where she's willing to cut it off at, you know? So, and this girl's shooting dope at 19. Geez, I started 18. The only thing you had me beat was you had a bank account at 19. I don't think I had a bank. I didn't have a bank account until I was about 26. When I first got sober, well, 2 years into my sobriety, my sobriety date is February 3rd, 1983. So a lot of you guys weren't born yet, which you don't need to tell me after the meeting because I really don't need to know it. But at about 2 years of sobriety, you know, like a lot of newcomers, we get these jobs that are just anything we can do to make money, you know. And I was working at a job where I had to punch a time card. Like, believe me, I never had a job in my life where I punched a time card. I left home at 16. I'm a Greenwich Village hippie. I worked in the music business from the time I was 17 years old until I was 39. I worked in the film business the rest of the time. We didn't have time clocks. But so when they gave me this piece of paper, I said, exempt, that sounds good. And I got called into the IRS at about 2 years of sobriety, and they went, where have you been for the last 13 years? I'm like, well, I know, it's a long story. But so thank you for your share. And, you know, it was very precise and to the point, because the reality of sobriety and the reality of recovery is that it's a simple thing, you know? I'm always amazed when I hear the fact where people stress this thing about you got to work the program, you got to do the steps this way. There's certain speakers that say if you don't do the steps this way, you're going to drink, you know? And we were talking about it earlier. There's a documented talk of Bill Wilson speaking in 1957 where he said don't make a project out of working the steps, you know? What we're here to do is share our experience, strength, and hope with another individual one-on-one. And tell them, how do we live life's term? How do we live life on life's terms and not drink or get loaded? I started drinking at 13. I started taking drugs at 14. By the time I was 18 years old, I was doing IV drugs. You know, I was basically a garbage can. I started getting high when I woke up, and I didn't stop until I passed out. You know, and I didn't plan on that. You know, I grew up with a father who was a basketball coach at a college and an ex-cop, and I, you know, grew up in a very dysfunctional situation. I was taken away from my parents by child services and put in an orphanage when I was about 3 and a half. I remember my grandmother coming to rescue me. Earl, would you hand me that bottle of water on the other side? My grandmother came to rescue me and take myself and my sister away. My mother was a drunk at 19 years old when she had me. When I figured out that I was born 5 months after the wedding, I asked her about the math. And her answer was, well, you are a mistake, which is what every little kid wants to hear, you know, that you're a mistake, right? And what it was is she was under the boardwalk at Jones Beach outside of New York City and had a little too much to drink, and one thing led to another, and I came up, you know. And My mother died at 47 years old from alcoholism. Flipped her car 6 times, broke her neck and back, was on a ventilator until we pulled the plug. You know, my stepfather died at 52. He was a patch-wearing biker killed in a shootout in a desert in Tucson, Arizona, and is buried out there somewhere, and nobody knows where he is. You know, completely violent. I met my stepfather on Christmas morning. It was a really nice gift. He and my mother were sleeping on the pull-out couch next to the Christmas tree, and I said, "Where'd this guy come from? I'd never seen him before." And she had picked him up from Sing Sing, which is a prison outside of New York City, where he had just gotten out for doing 3 to 5. And my mother used to drive his mother to visits. And so if I'd gotten out of jail after 3.5 years, I'd want to go out with a 6'2" woman and have a few cocktails, you know. So that was the introduction to my stepfather, who is a real piece of work. But I didn't plan on getting sober. I didn't wake up one day and think, wow, my life's unmanageable. I'm spiritually bankrupt. Maybe I should call Scripps or Promises or, you know, one of these 1-800 numbers, you know? I mean, I thought I was a victim of bad breaks and misunderstandings. And if only everybody else had just done it the way I thought they should do it, my life would have been good, you know? Everything would be okay if you just listen to me. I have a few ex-girlfriends that'll tell you exactly that. But I started hitting my bottom in 1976. I started getting to the point where I was drinking full-time every day, all day, doing what we do to stay awake at night. I was having stare-down contests through mini blinds with people from outer space. And there were two kinds. There were the tall ones with hoods with red eyes, and there were little guys that scampered around on the rooftops. And then there were always the guys with rifles in the trees, you know. And you know, and that was just the beginning of the spiral. You know what I mean? And drinking myself to sleep and just doing everything I could to be asleep before the sun came up. And I was never going to be an alcoholic, you know. I came out of Greenwich Village in the psychedelic age, working in the music business. I mean, if only I hadn't been stoned, I might have remembered some of the concerts I went to, you know. I have like brief photographs, snapshots in my minds of places that I've been and people that I've met, but I have no recollection of much anything else. But the reality of it was, it just continued to spiral down, you know. And I had worked, as I said, I worked for some decent people. And this one group I'd worked with for about 5 years, and we were doing a lot of big things and doing stadium shows down here and all over the country and Europe. And I just kept doing what I was doing, even while I was on the road and really doing things you shouldn't be doing when you're working. And I got fired by a practicing heroin addict because I couldn't do my job anymore. And I'd been with this band for 5 years and thought I was in solid, you know. And then that was the next level of my bottom, you know, because all of a sudden I realized, wow, what's going on now? And I went home to see my wife, who I'd met working on a show one time. And by noon, we were hanging out in the back doing coke. A couple of weeks later, she invited me over to her house, walked in the house, and it was not a good... I can't say it's not a good thing. For somebody like me, it was a life-changing spiritual experience. She liked to drink. She liked to do cocaine with an IV. And she was a bisexual that was into bondage. And I was like, take me home, you know? And she had a girlfriend that was pretty good-looking. But I moved in 3 weeks later, and we got married 5 months later. But when I came home off of this particular work situation, she had been living with the coke dealer for the last 5 months down the street, and so we got divorced. But it was like we didn't sleep much, so it was really a longer relationship than it felt like. This is a little bit of a sidestep, but when I got sober, you know, we all love to work the steps out of sequence when we're new because, you know, we have ulterior motives. So as soon as I thought about making amends, she was the first person I called because I was lonely, and she basically hung up on me. But then one day, and I used to work in the film studios for the last umpteen years or whatever, but I was on a set and I looked over and I saw this woman and I said to one of the guys that worked for me, who is that? And it turned out that it was my ex-wife and I hadn't seen her in about 17 or 18 years at the time, and she'd aged poorly due to her drinking and everything else. And today she's actually sober 5 years, and a friend of mine's wife sponsors her, which is a miracle because I can pick out 5 people in the front row that should be dead. You know, so all of us, anybody that can get sober for any amount of time, we're so blessed. And for me, what happened was I went and pulled a little geographic where I thought I was just going to drink light beer and smoke a little pot, you know, because that's the manageable way that we do things around here. So I went to Tucson because I had some family, and within 6 months I was right back to doing everything that I'd ever done. You know, my managing and controlling went right out the window. I was telling war stories. People were packing my nose for free. I got a job working at a bar. You know, what else does an alcoholic do but get to the source as quickly as possible, you know? Make best friends with the biggest coke dealers in the city. And then within 2 years of that, I was being threatened to be turned into a cornerstone at a strip mall because I'd done some very bad things to some very bad people that I shouldn't have done that were transplants from New York to Tucson. And I literally did a transaction in the middle of the night, stole some money, stole a car, and hightailed it out of Tucson back to L.A., thinking that surely I can find something to do in L.A. and hiding out. I was literally sleeping in the hills of Hollywood in a Volkswagen Rabbit. In case you can't tell, I'm 6'6". It wasn't the smartest choice I ever made to sleep in a car with a stick shift. And, you know, I would park up in the hills on these turnouts, and I would put towels up in the window in case the cops came by to rouse me, because I figured if the cops came, I need to get my hair together, because it was, you know, the early 80s. And I was cleaning up in a park. I'd go to the bathrooms in Plummer Park in Hollywood, which is a really skeevy neighborhood. And I was going to Ralph's, and I was stealing lunch meat because it was flat and I could slip it down my pants. And I literally was running out of money. I had no idea what I was going to do. I was looking for couches to crash on. You know, I called up one friend of mine that I had worked with who was another complete maniac, and I went over to his house, and he was sitting in his bedroom with his trying to figure out how to hook his toe on a shotgun trigger. And I'm like, what am I around? You know, my life was unwinding, and everybody around it was clearly right with me. And I was lucky that one guy took a phone call, because I'd been 86 from a lot of studios and 86 from people, places, and things where nobody wanted me around anymore. You know, I did not have a good reputation. Because I was one of those guys, I'll gladly pay you on Tuesday for a couple of grams or an ounce today, you know, and then Tuesday comes and you're on to the next guy. And one guy took my call and he said, you know what, I'll meet you for dinner. He goes, come on over to Barney's Beanery. And if any of you are familiar with Barney's Beanery, it's this crazy old rock and roll Irish bar in West Hollywood where the Doors used to hang out and all this crazy stuff and 180 kinds of beer, and my friend came and met me, and I thought, man, all I want, hopefully he'll buy me dinner, hopefully he lets me come to his house where I can take a shower, because I hadn't had a shower in about a week, and he owned his own studio, and I thought, maybe he'll let me come hang out at the studio, and I can get some work, make some money, do something. And he came in, and he sat down, and he goes, yeah, hey, there's another guy who's coming to have dinner with us. And I went, who's that? And he goes, it's my friend Charlie, he's my sponsor. And I was like, okay, so what does that mean, you know? And he goes, well, I've been in AA for a year and a half, and I have 90 days. And I'm like, 90 days of what, you know? He's like, well, I'm clean and sober. And I'm like, okay, what? I mean, my relationship, to any 12-step program was nil. You know, I thought easy does it meant don't tailgate, you know? I mean, when you worked in rock and roll in the 70s, it's not like we had Blue Cross Blue Shield, you know what I mean? It's not like we knew about, well, for one, there was no such thing as a sober living. There was a few treatment centers like Cry Help or Impact, you know, but not very many places other than that, Claire. You know, so it's not like we had this wealth of information available to us to help us get sober. And this guy Charlie showed up, and he's like, you know, well, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, because he had 11 months and the other guy had 90 days, and so I was their prime new 12 step. You know, we got one. Let's see what we can do. You know, and. You know, and all I'm doing is sitting there shaking my head. Sure, yeah, okay, whatever, you know. And then my friend said all that I needed to hear was, you know, if you're willing to come with us to a meeting tomorrow night, you can come stay at my place tonight and come to the studio tomorrow. And I was like, I scored, because they bought me a beer, they bought me a hamburger, and now I got everything I need to get through one more day. Because if you think staying sober one day at a time is tough, try living on the streets one day at a time. You know, try not knowing where your next meal is coming from one day at a time, you know, where your next bed is going to be or any of that stuff. And they basically took me to a meeting the next day. And when I woke up that day, it's not like I thought, this seems like a good day to get sober. This seems like the day that I'm never going to use or drink again, you know. That wasn't in my agenda. And I had the experience of coming to a meeting, not much different than this, with a guy at a podium talking about his stories. You know, the thing that, I read these things, and they really freaked me out because they had God in it. And then they had, you know, most of it sounded like Chinese arithmetic. And then the speaker talked about fighting a federal case and getting in the men's room and getting on his knees in a stall praying, and I'm like, what is wrong with these people? I'm not getting on my knees for anybody. You know, and I'm sitting there counting Rolexes and judging everybody in the room, thinking, you know, who are these losers? I wouldn't get high with one of you guys in this room. You know, typical egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know, I'm looking up from the gutter judging all these people in the room that are sober, and some of them sober a good bit, you know. And then the first miracle happened for me that I actually recognized was that they opened up the meeting of participation, and some guy in the back of the room raised his hand to share, and he looked like Kramer from Seinfeld, who'd been tweaking, you know, and he had talked about, I thought he was some like Hollywood Boulevard street urchin because he had that kind of look going on, and he shared that he had had time. You know, that he had had 9 months of sobriety and that he'd gone out. And he went on to describe his relapse. And I related to every single thing because I didn't relate to the speaker at all. The speaker was talking about making millions of dollars, losing millions of dollars. Now he's making millions of dollars again. And look at me. Don't I look great? And this guy in the back was skinny and gaunt and tweaky and shaking and talking about his relapse. And I identified with every single thing he did. And then he said, the first thing I heard at a meeting that got my attention. He said, the reason he was back in a meeting is because this is where the hope is. Now, when you're 31 years old and you've been working in a certain business for about 12 or 13 years and you've traveled around the world and your own sister says she wouldn't spit on your grave, you've kind of come to destroy everything that you know. Every relationship I've had, every opportunity I had, I wiped it out completely. So hope was a big commodity because I grew up with a stepfather who one of his grand comments was, what are you going to be when you grow up? You're going to be a piece of crap. You're not going to amount to anything. You're going to be a garbage man. That's the best you're ever going to be. You know, the constant shaming and berating. And you get to a point when you're bottoming out that you're starting to believe that stuff. Your head is starting to tell you, maybe I am that piece of crap. Maybe I am crazy. Maybe there really is something wrong with me, you know? And then I found out what was wrong with me. Because after that meeting, the old timer that was running the meeting came up and he said, kid, you got a big book? And I'm like, I don't even know what a big book is at the time. And he goes, here, here's a book. And he goes, He goes, you seem like you're one of the sick ones. You can skip the first two chapters. I want you to go to chapter 3, more about alcoholism. He goes, I want you to identify with the feelings and the similarities that you come across here. And he goes, you got a place to stay? And my friend had walked up and said, well, as long as you're willing to come to meetings, you can stay on my couch. And I slept on his couch for 5.5 months. And I went back that night and I read chapter 3, which was read here tonight. And as soon as I got through the first two pages, it was like a wall fell on me. Because I wasn't a drunk. Drunks were my mother. Drunks were my stepfather. Drunks were clock radios being thrown across the room or people being stabbed with forks at dinner time. I mean, craziness, you know. Those were drunks. I wasn't going to be one of those. Then I started to read about alcoholism. And then I started to read about trying to control my drinking and using. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but there were a lot of nights I went to bed and there was Heineken in the refrigerator, a couple of joints on the nightstands, and a couple of bumps. And every morning I'd wake up and some homeless guy had broken in and stolen all my stash. You know? Or how many times, you know, I did the let me pay you on Tuesday for a little action today, and then you're leaving town. You know what I mean? So doing the same thing, expecting different results. And then it got to the story of the jaywalker that keeps running out in front of the buses and gets out from the hospital with broken arms and broken legs, and it talks about the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. When you do IV usage, you're jaywalking with a bullet train because you don't know what's going to happen in a second. And I'm not kidding, a second. I've come to the next day, and the last thing I remember is sitting in a chair. You know, there's numerous times where my wife that I talked about, I watched her turn blue one day right in front of me, you know, and I was next. If not for just seconds and inches, I was next. And, I just completely lost my train of thought.
Powerlessness.
Chapter 3. And I read that, and I thought, alcoholism, maybe this is what's wrong with me. Now, I'm a 31-year-old street punk that left home at 16 and have taken care of myself, and nobody was going to tell me what to do. And I thought, I have alcoholism, this is killing me. I haven't had a drink since that day. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is how does that fucking happen? You know, when I look back on it now, it was a surrender. I surrendered to the disease because I recognized the desperation in my life. If you're new in here, I pray that you're desperate. Because if you're not, death is right around the corner with its arms open. A young man I know last week, nobody heard from him on Saturday and Sunday, found him dead with a needle in his arm, and he worked making good money. Life got shiny. Life gets shiny, and complacency and inappropriate behavior slip right back in the back door, you know? And so if you're here, pray that you're desperate. If you don't know what desperation is, ask your sponsor and let your sponsor tell you what's going on, because the spiral will just keep taking you down and down and down, you know. My friend Danny T used to always say, brain broke, jails, institution, and death. Those are the only two things you need to know. My friend Tom Kenny used to say, you want to work the first three steps? Make your bed, brush your teeth, get a job. Those are the first three steps for a newcomer, you know. And, you know, I was blessed that I was around people that really made me pay attention. I've been going to the same men's stag for over 36 years. When I first went, I had 60 days. I'm feeling my oats, you know. I'm talking shit. I'm running my mouth. You know how we can be. And an old-timer, John James, took me to this meeting. And his sponsor was there. And his sponsor looked over at me and just shook his head and goes, "Kid, you need to just sit down and shut the fuck up." And I was like, wow, how offensive is this guy? You know, my head was like, you know, ripping him a new one. But then he did the thing that old timers used to do. After the meeting, he came up to me and he said, "Look," he goes, "the reason we tell you that is we care more about your life than your feelings." And I was like, oh, I get it. Because we see that you're dying. You might not see it. You might not even know it. But you keep doing what you're doing, you're dying. Jails, institutions, and death. You know? And I've seen it. I've lost track of the people that I know that, you know, died from the disease. And in case you don't know, I drove 3 hours and I'm really tired and my brain's just starting to take huge, massive drops. It's like, oh, what were you talking about? You know, the reality of it is, and somebody, I think Robert said that he got a sponsor and it changed his life. You know, I've had 5 sponsors. Unfortunately, 2 of the guys that I've had the privilege of being sponsored died in the last couple of years. And, but you know, I worked with these guys. I mean, somebody else shared earlier, I was at a meeting and I heard about sponsors. We used to also have this line, if you kill yourself before you turn 5 years sober, you're probably killing the wrong person. So I heard that. I kind of got that, you know, that your head might not even come out of your butt until you got 5 years. So I thought, well, I'm going to get a sponsor that has at least 5 years because I don't want them getting loaded while I'm in the middle of working my steps. So there was a guy at my meeting, and he was about 6'4", and he lifted weights, and he had a red Porsche 944 and a beautiful girlfriend. And I thought, well, that guy's got what I want. I mean, you know, what do I know? And he sponsored me for about 2 or 3 weeks, and we're still friends to this day, but he relapsed at 22 years and almost died, you know. But what happened for me was that I went to another men's stag, and I sat down next to somebody, and they went, "You're new, aren't you?" I'm like, how do those guys know that all the time, you know? Must have been my foot going up and down at about 1,000 beats a second. And he said, "You know what?" He goes, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I went, "No, not really." He goes, "Well, I'm going to be your interim sponsor." He goes, "I have a big book study at my house. Why don't you come over?" So I went over to his house to this big book study, a bunch of men sitting in a circle with big books. And, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing, you know. And it goes around in a circle to share, and it gets to the guy next to me, and he's celebrating his 5th birthday. And his book is opened, and it's underlined in like 5 different colors ink. And when he gets called on to share, he's talking about what was suggested to him and his experiences are. Everything was relational, you know. I could understand everything he talked about. And I asked him to be my sponsor. He lived 3 houses away from the couch I was sleeping on. This year I got to give him a 42-year cake. He lives on the East Coast now, but we're still in contact, you know. And what he did was he took me through the big book, 1 page at a time, with a highlighter. In West Hollywood, I got on the floor, on my knees, held his hands, and said the 3rd step prayer. That was a big fucking deal. But, you know, I started to read and I started to understand what was being talked about there. I started to understand the concept of the disease. I started to understand the concept of resentments. You know, when you get into talking about, you know, inventory and whatnot, it talks about on page 66, it says, you know, resentments are the number one offender. And then it goes on to talk about that to hold on to a resentment, the insanity of alcohol will return. And when it returns, we drink. And if we drink, we die. And the part of that that jumped out at me was the insanity of alcohol will return. It doesn't say I'm going to drink and then get crazy. It says I'm going to get crazy and then I'm going to drink. That's called untreated alcoholism. I see it all the time. We were talking earlier. Most of the guys I sponsor now are between 18 and 30 years sober. Most of them because they've chased the shiny things and found out it didn't work. Or they've had successes and they quit going to meetings. I was talking to a friend of mine today or yesterday who's become extremely successful. He's on a sitcom. He's making money. I said, "Why are you so miserable?" when was the last time you went to a meeting? He goes, well, I've been to two meetings this year. I said, dude, it's April. And he's got substantial time. He's got 16 years. And I said, are you happy? He goes, my life is great. I said, are you happy? He goes, no, not really. I said, is your girlfriend happy? Because, you know, he has a partner. He goes, no, she's really pissed off at me. I said, why is that? He goes, because I snap at her all the time and I talk down to her. And I said, where's God in that? You know, and he says he's going to go to a meeting. But I've had that conversation with numerous men that aren't here anymore. You know, that aren't here anymore. Myself and the people I know, we're not the kind of people that go out and decide, yeah, I'm going to have a Heineken and sneak in the bathroom and do a couple of bumps. That's not the MO that me and my friends know. You know, we're more like, oh, we're going to do this. It might involve a plane ticket to Thailand, but if we're going to do this, we're going to do this, you know. And the reality, like I started to say earlier about working the steps, I've dug ditches in Arizona in August. That's work. I've never got up in the morning and prayed and meditated and thought, I'm exhausted, you know. I've never, like, you know, sat down and read a couple of chapters of the big book and thought, wow, I need a shower. I mean, I've read some fifth steps that made me think I should take a shower, you know. But the reality of it is what we're presented it with is a process, just a process. I mean, clearly a process. There's nothing here that none of us can't do, you know, nothing. Even the simplest thing, prayer and meditation, one sentence can be your prayer. You know, Al Sines, who just passed away, this friend of mine, had 54 years. When I was about 3.5 years sober, I was getting a little crazy. And he suggested I do another inventory, and then I did a fifth step with Father Francis that you guys know. And then I went back to Al, and I said, he told me I should start meditating. He goes, well, what does the 11 steps say? And I said, it says we need to pray and meditate. He goes, no, what does the 11 step pray say? And I said, it says we pray and meditate. He goes, why don't you open the book and read it? And I, oh, we seek to improve. He goes, yeah, you're seeking to improve. So it's like for guys that go to the gym or work out, you know, if you're working out with a trainer, you might do certain exercises for 90 days and then things get stale or you get bored and then you switch up your exercises. Howard P. and I used to have this conversation all the time. Howard P. would change his meditation techniques every 6 months. I change them about every 90 days because I have more ADD than Howard did. But the reality of it is, what do you have to do for today to be comfortable? Because if you're reading the 12 and 12 in the back of the book, Bill does a synopsis on the steps. When you go to the 12th step in the 12 and 12, there's three pages where he talks about a brief bit about what the steps are. Then he does three pages on carrying the message. But then the next 10 pages are practicing these principles in all of your affairs. And what he talked about is, I look at what my causes and conditions of each day are, and I ask for God for help with those things. Because every day when you're sober is life on life's terms. I had a friend 2 days ago that I play golf with all the time. He's driving down the freeway. Some guy texts. Next thing he knows, he's facing backwards with his face through the steering wheel and his leg through the door. You know, didn't do a thing. You know, he didn't do one thing. I have another friend that we got a haircut, walked out of a barber shop, was looking at his phone, somebody texting caused an accident, a Range Rover came up and ran him over. He was an investment banker in Beverly Hills. He lives with mom and dad at 44 years old and he can barely take care of himself because the entire left side, your brother was with him at the hospital, his entire left side of his body was crushed by this car. Sponsored guys went to meetings. There's no plan. You know, this thing about God has a plan. Everything happens for a reason. I sat with Dr. Paul and said, if there was anything you would change, what would it be? And he said that line. He said that. He said that at the powwow, actually, that we were talking about at dinner. I sat with Paul one day, and he said, yeah, there's no God pulling strings. There's no puppet. He goes, the universe works in its own way. It's creative intelligence. It just moves. So we don't know what's happening. So we get up one day at a time and we do the best we can. We try to find another alcoholic. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? My second day of sobriety, I went to Beverly Hills to meet my friend at this meeting called Rodeo in Beverly Hills. And it's a huge meeting. When you're new, it's really huge. But there's men in coats and ties. There's women in stoles with pearl necklaces. I mean, it was senior sobriety. Chuck Chamberlain used to hang out there. Different people. And it was a deep room. And I came in. I didn't see my friend. I'm standing in the back. I have my best Doobie Brothers shirt on and my hair perfectly coiffed, you know. My arms are folded. I'm about, let's see, I'm 225. I think I weighed 185, so I was about 40 pounds lighter. And I'm standing in the back, and I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing here? I feel so less than. What am I doing here? I got to get out of here. And from the front row, there's a middle aisle, and I see this big, tall, blonde actor who's on a TV show walking up the aisle, just looking at me like this, like zeroing in on the newcomer, look what I got. And he comes right up to me, and he goes, hey, what's your name? I've never seen you here before. And I go, Ken. He goes, it's so nice to see another tall guy I don't have to bend over to talk to. He goes, do you have a seat? I'm like, no, my friend isn't here. I was supposed to meet somebody. How long are you sober? I think it's 2 days. He goes, well, I got a seat for you. Come on. And he took me to the front of Rodeo and gave me a seat next to him, introduced me to everybody he knew. And then he said, do you want some coffee? Are you hungry? Do you need anything? And I went, I guess. And he went and got me coffee and cookies and took me under his wing, you know. And he and I are still friends today. You know, I still see him all the time. And at meetings, and when I told his second wife this story, she started crying, you know. But what that means is, and I think Earl and John were in Fort Lauderdale a couple of years ago, where I was telling this story, where I had spoken in Phoenix with Howard, and after I got done, I went outside, because it's hot in Phoenix, and I took off my tie and everything, and I'm standing there, and there's some guy chain smoking, and I go, hey man, what are you doing? I'm like, well, how much time do you have? 2 days? Well, what's going on? Well, my wife threw me out of the house. I can't see my kids. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, just crazed, right? Crazed. Well, where do you live? Well, I live in Gilbert. Dude, I have friends here from Gilbert. Howard, Terry. They have a men's stag on Monday night, dinner. Come on, let me hook you up with these guys. I drug them over to these guys and went, look what I got. It's a newcomer. Here, take him. He's yours. And then we were in Fort Lauderdale, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and I was telling this story, and my friend Terry had just gotten back from London, and he called me up and goes, dude, you're not going to believe this. I ran into that guy Nick. You remember that guy Nick? I'm like, yeah. He goes, yeah, his kids are grown up, all this stuff. And I said, oh, that's so great. What else is going on? He goes, well, there was one thing he never told us. And I went, what's that? He goes, he had a plan that night. He was going to go kill himself. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, he was going to go kill himself. And we're in Fort Lauderdale, and I get done talking, and I just told that story, and I'm standing there shaking people's hands, and this guy comes up and goes, hey, Ken, hi, nice to meet you. I'm Nick. And I go, hi, Nick, nice to meet you. And he goes, no, I'm that Nick. And I hadn't seen him in 12 years. And it's like, why did God... All I did was do what was done for me. Some guy took the time out and said, look at that big guy in the back who thinks he's so tough. He's probably just a scared little boy. Maybe he needs somebody to talk to. And when I walked out, I was like, wow, look at this guy, chain smoker, and he looks like he's fucking losing his mind. What's going on with him? 10 seconds of your life can change somebody's life. Because not only did Nick take me around and introduce me to his family, but he told me the story of his kids. He told me the story. I mean, everything, you know. Because what happens here is the chains get broken, you know. All I do is tell you what I was told. All I do is share what I've done. All I do is just keep showing up. I still have the same home group for 36 years. You know, I still sponsor guys. I still read the same big book every day. I still have the same 12 and 12 I read all the time. I have a 12 and 12 on my phone. I used to have a 12 and 12 in my glove box before we had phones that we could download stuff on. But the real miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's really just one person working with another alcoholic. You can go to all the meetings you want. It's not going to keep you sober. But you go through the big book and the 12 and 12 with a sponsor, and you go through one line at a time, one page at a time, and you ask questions, and you get vulnerable, and you learn to be authentic and curious, you can save your life, you know? Your family never has to deal with your insanity again. You never have to listen to your head again, although that's a lie. You should have heard some of the shit it was telling me sitting in traffic on the 5 today coming down here. What am I down to, like 1 minute, 30 seconds? So anyway, the reality of Alcoholics Anonymous is it's truly a simple process, but you can't do it alone. It's a we program, not a me program. I will die, I will kill myself, I will make you crazy, I will ruin my life. We can do this together with the help of a higher power and with the strength of what Alcoholics Anonymous gives us, of one alcoholic caring for another alcoholic. Thanks.